now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
Dean Haglund, tell me how the Pay Per Laughs show has been changing the way people attend comedy.
I'll tell you, it's made a huge impact. It's actually amazing. I think I'm making more on Pay Per Laughs than I would had I charged tickets. Because I reiterate that, you determine what this is worth. What is a good laugh worth? What is an hour of solid, gut-busting, cheek-hurting laugh worth to you? And how that removes the cortisol, the hormone, stress hormone from your body. You are doing things that pharmaceuticals could never possibly do in a million years. And look at how much you pay for your pharmaceuticals. And then they line up, and it's fantastic.
I wonder if also this idea that you're not paying admission price, if this actually opens people up to laughter more because they're more relaxed when they arrive, when they come in, as opposed to this idea of, oh God, I hope this is worth the money I spent.
Well, this is the thing, I often go, well, let's see a comic. But at $50, $25, I don't know if he's funny. And then, so I already have this anxiety going in. And then there's like, yeah, I guess that was all right. Like, you're already prejudging it. Whereas you go, Pay Per Laughs, oh, you know what? Doesn't matter, man. If he sucks, I don't pay. So all that pressure's off. Everybody comes in just anxiety-free. And why not, when so many other freelance jobs are paid by the performance that you give, should not comedy be the same way?
And what are those other jobs?
Say graphic arts, oil painting, artists.
Arts, you're paid up front.
But you oil painting, you just pay on spec, and then you have a gallery show.
Oil painting's a job?
As a fine artist. You do a bunch of canvases, and then you take them to a gallery, and then you hope to sell some based on the quality of the work and how it resonates with the public.
And then
That's long it. After you're dead, if you do it right, other people not related.
I'm sorry, other people not related to you, long after you're dead, will make lots and lots of money off your efforts. It's so funny. I forgot that we were recording a show right now, and I just dropped the microphone and was talking to you. Dean can hear me. It's on Skype. And all right. Through the magic of podcasting. I'm back, ladies and gentlemen.
Phil Lairness, ladies and gentlemen.
So two weeks in the books, right, of the Pay Per Laughs show.
Yes, absolutely.
And so, more upcoming?
More upcoming. Got one tonight. This Monday, at 5 Eliza Street in Newtown, New South Wales, in Australia.
Now,
if you're there.
Now, people, there is audience participation in this show. And is there any effect, the nature of this is a paper laugh show, as opposed to one where people are paying to get in. Has that affected in any way the audience participation elements of it?
Hmm. No, it hasn't. I think that's still, you know, you're breaking the fourth wall. There's still that fun tension of, oh, dear Lord, he can see us. It's not television. I'm looking back, you know, that kind of thing.
So there isn't more or less eagerness on the part of an audience to be your guinea pigs.
Absolutely not. I think they're now they're curious as to what will unfold. So it has the same amount of the perfect amount of reluctance and or willingness to participate.
Well, I would certainly, if I were called up, I would calculate how many laughs you generated while I was up there, and I would deduct that from what I would pay you.
I think some people did, because, you know, I don't hold anybody to the math, really, at the end. I sort of give, that's my secret reveal. That's my one spoiler from this whole show, that I haven't actually been keeping tabs. I trust the honor system.
You are not actually recording how many laughs.
No.
Per person.
No, I'm hoping they are counting or getting a general feel of how much they laughed versus how many other times they laughed at shows.
I'd be really interested in what the tipping point is from an economic factor of how big a crowd might generate the same amount of money as a much larger crowd. You know, because I imagine that there's a little psychology of, okay, maybe we're a smaller crowd, but it's a funny show, so we're going to be really generous. Whereas the same level of a funny show with a much bigger crowd, people might be less generous individually because they go, well, look at all the people here.
Wow, I had not put that economic scale in there.
I bet there's some tipping point on that, don't you think? I mean,
yeah. So now in my future shows, I'm actually going to limit the amount of people. No, I'm not going to do that.
No, I just wonder. It's like passing the hat at a church, right?
Right.
Smaller congregation might give more. Per person.
Per
obviously.
Person. Yeah, right. Yeah. So, well, we'll be finding that out in the future as the audience grows.
Fascinating. Yes. As you reveal the exact dollar figures here on the show.
Exactly. On the month of January, it broke down to these numbers.
Did you go to another convention this weekend?
I did. I was in Brisbane, or as they call it, Bris Vegas, because it has one casino. Yeah, I know. The Brizzy Supernova was this weekend, hanging out with such luminaries as Nick Frost from Shaun of the Dead,
right?
Chris Judge from Stargate SG-1. Who else was there? The voice of Dragon Ball Z, Sean, what's his face? And
wow, that's nice.
And famous Australian comedian Richard.
Famous, so famous.
Say it, Richard the King. He's known as the King. He retired from stand up 12 years ago. Undefeated as the King of stand-up comedy in Australia.
When you're saying what's his name and things like that, it is really some powerful name dropping.
Oh,
you know, I went, it was my birthday this past week.
Happy birthday,
well,
by the way.
That's not the reason I bring it up. But the reason that I bring it up is I'd been dying to go to the remodeled, reopened Clifton's Cafeteria in downtown Los Angeles.
Oh,
and
that's on my list.
It has just been so packed that you just can't get in.
Is that right?
So I knew that my birthday, which was the night before Thanksgiving, would be the perfect time. There's fewer people in town Thanksgiving week, and obviously the night before Thanksgiving, people are not going out for a big meal, especially the restaurant whose most popular cafeteria entree is the full Thanksgiving dinner every night of the week. So people not coming en masse for that. So anyway, got a private dining room behind the second floor bar. There's a bar on the second floor. There's a gothic bar on the third floor. Of course, a tiki bar is going to open on the fourth floor, and then a fine dining steakhouse is going to open on the fifth floor. But the first three floors are open. There has been change in terms of the layout, but all the decor is original, just slightly remodeled and refurbished and things like this. But
tell me, is the raccoon still popping up and down in the forest?
Maybe. There is a lot of the forest, but I mean, it really felt like I was glamping this year for my birthday. Glamorous camping there in my reserve private party. You know, you still get the food from the cafeteria. It's a swanky cafeteria now.
Yeah.
And then you go upstairs, you bring your tray up, and then you go to your private room, if you're Phil Lairness, and you get fantastic service from the bar. And here's the thing, for a guy that really doesn't drink much anymore, not too often anyway.
Right.
It's really hard to keep track of how drunk you are when the people around you are far more drunk.
There was no designated driver since your downtown all public transit leads
exactly,
home.
Exactly. Right. So I'll be posting the photos, but what a fun historic thing. And my favorite part was just grabbing my cocktail and wandering through the various floors and looking, seeing, wow, the meditation cave is still the same. Great. And then, wow, they brought out the old original bandstand. And, you know, and you really sense the ghosts in the place. I mean, just so many terrific nooks and crannies on that place. Just so much fun to stroll around and explore.
Have they highlighted the longest continuous burning neon tube that was behind the wall they accidentally discovered?
I think they may have highlighted that, although that just felt to me like the flush in my cheeks from all the mere woods that I was drinking.
Wow. Now, did you have to book ahead the private dining room? Is that the deal?
Yeah, I sent a little email reservation. They're not the savviest in terms of all that. They had no record of it, and so... all I had to do that night was say, yeah, I demanded, well, did you want a private room? Yeah, well, yes, I did. So, but okay. It was fun. Stepping back into history. And here's the part of it that I loved the best. Because, of course, I always loved Clifton's Cafeteria. And we've talked about this on the show. So many people survived the Depression because of Clifton's Cafeteria. The other restaurants that Clifford Clinton ran offering credit, offering pay what you can, offering the ability to buy meal tickets to give to other people. So much great stuff that this guy did. Made a ton of money doing the right thing during the Depression. I mean, imagine that, letting people eat for free, and he's still making so much money, making money doing the right thing. And then putting his money into efforts to clean up the corrupt Los Angeles Police Department. So great stuff. So it's always been near and dear to my heart. But there was always something about walking into Clifton's that felt like you were walking into a museum, right?
Yes.
And now the renovation, the effect of the renovation and the refurbishment and the reopening is I feel like I'm walking in and getting a sense of how original customers felt when they came in. Because at that time, that place was swanky.
Yes, it was brand new.
And the food was, for that era, incredibly healthy. That was their mandate. Yeah. It has to be healthy food. Now, what they considered healthy food, first of all, it was healthier than a lot of our foods now because they didn't have the chemicals and the processing and all that kind of stuff that we did.
Right, before Monsanto.
But their meat and potatoes diet, let's say, you know, they may not have had the range of fresh vegetables and things like that we have today, but but so I feel like that's it. It's what would you call it? I mean, it's a comparable experience is what I felt like, updated to acknowledge the modernity in which we live, but to give ourselves a feeling of the thrill of what it was like for patrons during the restaurant's heyday.
I believe the term is parallax experience.
I believe that's the name of our podcast from here on in.
The Parallax.
This is your Parallax experience.
Fantastic.
Anyway, I could go on and on about this, and I won't. So,
I will. Well, we'll compare notes because when I'm back in Los Angeles at Christmas time, on my list of places to go is the old Clifton's Cafeteria.
Yeah, just don't be one of these people who then gets all hipper than thou and complains about it. Like, I keep hearing about, the service is bad, and, the food isn't that great. It's a cafeteria, people. It's still a cafeteria. You know,
what service do you get at a cafeteria?
Exactly.
Serve yourself.
And the bartender that I met here in the neighborhood, I may have mentioned this on the show, a couple weeks ago, you know, I asked him, is the food good? And he said, that's the wrong question. And everybody keeps asking it and keeps criticizing it. Yes, the food is good. But is the food good when it's been sitting out for an hour? Because it is a cafeteria.
Yeah, right.
Right? And so everybody like, oh, I don't know, this doesn't feel so fresh, or this doesn't. It's, did you notice when you got the food from the cafeteria that it's a cafeteria?
Right. It sits under a hot lamp for a while. That's
anyway. So it was Thanksgiving. Did you celebrate American Thanksgiving down under?
Sure did. Had some friends over and tried to give them the full experience. Of course, very hard to find cranberries here. They don't have that. We finally found it at a store frozen. A turkey. Not really a lot of people eat turkeys here. So we drove all over.
Because down under, the turkeys kill you.
That's right. They're drop turkeys. And then so we cooked a goose. And then their pumpkins here are butternut squashes that they call pumpkins. So you can't really make a pumpkin pie because it'll come out as a butternut squash pie, which I don't think exists as a thing. So we made a lemon meringue pie, which was delightful. And so, yeah, we had the version of American Thanksgiving, and all our friends to celebrate brought guns. And I think that was a mockery, but, you know, whatever.
I received an email. I love Thanksgiving, always been my favorite holiday. As I say before, people say, oh, wouldn't it be great if Christmas could last year round? No, not really. But Thanksgiving, that I would love. A whole
year
thing
round.
About just celebrating gratitude.
Exactly.
As it is, we already are advertising Christmas the moment Halloween ends. Because we can't monetize gratitude. Thanksgiving's been encroached and reduced now to a handful of hours because we got to start Black Friday early. That's enough being grateful for what you already have. Now go buy more shit. and yet this is the holiday that celebrates an energy and an emotional truth that could actually transform things, that could actually have positive ramifications throughout the year, i.e. the idea of being grateful not just for the shit we like, but for everything. Being grateful. I received an email from Robert Reich. I'm not alone. It was a mass email. The labor secretary under Clinton, who's a very wise man, brilliant thinker, and the chancellor.
Berkeley professor.
Chancellor of public policy at Berkeley. And and he sent an email about the things that he's grateful for. And I thought, well, that's nice. And I'm going to read this. And what a nice list it is. And then he had to go into the 10 things I'm least grateful for. And this is on Thanksgiving. And I wanted to write back, you know what I'm least grateful for? Your list. That's what I'm least grateful for. Because, you know, you're a leader. You're a thinker. How about you take the quote-unquote 10 things you're least grateful for and you make another list, which is the 10 things that I find most challenging, not least grateful, I find most challenging to be grateful for and why I'm grateful for them.
There you go.
Because everything serves. If you're going to hold up your political enemies, your political opponents and their ideas as things you're not grateful for, how about flipping it and realizing that those people and their ideas are creating, in part, the structure and the framework that allows you to share with me right now your supposedly better ideas?
Right.
Right.
You wouldn't have those better ideas, quote unquote, had there not been something to bounce off of, a
gratitude,
shadow.
Gratitude transforms, and this does not mean you have to say, oh, I'm glad it happened, whatever it was.
Right.
It's to say that it served in some way. We made the movie The Truth Is Out There, and we were struck, were we not, by how many people's personal journey of artistic journey, journey into exploration of mythology, into health, personal health. So many things were inspired by the events of 9/11. Horrible events. Nobody would say, yes, let's do that again. And yet people's lives were transformed for the better because of their choice of how they responded to it. So they are grateful for what happened. When we went and spoke on a 10th anniversary of 9/11, and so many people in the truth movement there, and so many people, you know, who still feel, you know, the real pain of this thing happening, but at the same time, look at all the friends, the lifelong friends they met and discovered because of a shared commitment to try to find out what happened. That doesn't mean you would wish it all to happen again, but boy, isn't that a major reason to be grateful for it, because look at this family you've found for yourself. So there are always ways to do it. I don't do it all the time. Nobody does it all the time. But at least once a year, shouldn't that be the point of the day, is take everything that's not easy for you to find gratitude for and figure out a way you can, at least one day a year.
That's all. That's all we ask.
All right. I'm going to put the soapbox away for just a moment.
Just bring it back. Don't pack it.
Oh, no. It'll be coming back. But I need to play a little jingle that we call Celebrity Deaths.
Uh-huh.
Because we have a great one to discuss.
Celebrity Deaths.
This comes to us from the faraway shores of Japan. Closer to you, probably, than for me now. But wonderful, wonderful actress. One of Japan's most beloved actresses, Setsuko Hara, died at 95. She was best known, really, as the muse for Yasujirō Ozu in such films of his as Late Spring and the all-time masterpiece Tokyo Story, which continues with each passing year to climb the charts in my heart of my favorite movies, regularly, you know, voted one of the 10 greatest films ever made. And she was very much his muse in his films. I mean, her portrayals of women torn between demands of family and expressing their own unique desires in a post-war Japan that was really wrestling with these ideas were just so subtle and so dignified. I mean, there is such a modernity in the subtlety of her performances. Anyway, she died on September 5th in Kamakura. But the Kyoto News Agency only announced her death this past Wednesday because it turns out that family members had waited until then to make the news of her death public. Can you imagine in America the impossibility of keeping something like that private until you as a family were ready to discuss it? Impossible.
Impossible. So then therefore her funeral and all of that was not mobbed by an adoring public, I take it.
I guess not. Yeah.
The family grieved privately, had a funeral, and then announced it so that everyone else could share in the memories of her.
And she worked with, obviously, a who's who of great filmmakers, also worked with Kurosawa. And as I think we've mentioned before, when, you know, august film personages in Japan have died, the way that they as a nation really are moved by the loss of these people is so touching. So touching. There seems to be a sense that they do, I guess it's not a surprise that that culture honors their ancestors a little bit more than we do. That's part and parcel with it. But it is, you know, refreshing to see that this, their cultural ancestors as well.
Right. Exactly.
So
there you go. Well,
anyway, that move on my birthday, finding out that this beloved actress and I found out through a post announced by the Criterion Collection. I got an email. You know, I enjoy collecting some of the Criterion Collection editions of great movies, and they emailed their members list about this person's death. And and I thought that was quite touching. I mean, obviously, it also serves just in time for Black Friday of all the Setsuko Hara vehicles that they sell through Criterion. But I prefer to thank them for celebrating her, right?
Right, so, right, exactly. That's only just a byproduct.
You know, speaking of celebrating classic cinema and cultural contributors, you and I have been participating in an ongoing series called The Culture Shapers. About classic science fiction films. And one that I got to do a week before last, after I'd already spoken on 2001, A Space Odyssey, shared some of those insights with you on this show. And, of course, I'd also done, well, you did Metropolis.
I did Metropolis, the 1927 silent science fiction film.
And I did. I began the whole series with Logan's Run, because where would you begin? Classic science fiction than with Logan's Run. But actually, it turned out to be surprisingly a really appropriate place to start, because that movie has a lot of on its mind. But
sure does.
But I got to do one of the unquestionable classics of the genre, Forbidden Planet.
Fantastic.
And it was such an honor, after having already been able to do 2001 and Logan's Run, to be called upon to do Forbidden Planet, so much so that I could only ask myself, gee, I wonder who canceled.
And who canceled?
I don't know. But we had a great time talking about Forbidden Planet. And I got to tell you, in rewatching it, and this was the second time in the past year I've watched the film, actually. But unlike with Logan's Run in 2001, even, I would go long stretches without writing down any notes, because I was just so captured by watching it again. That film,
really,
you know, it's directed by someone who, like, their other high points in their directing career was Lassie movies, right? So it's not got a great deal of personality behind the directing, which is why, right, I think people keep bringing up every so often that so-and-so is going to remake it, you know, some auteur is going to remake it. But
the
dialogue, every other line of dialogue in this film is so good, and the influence that this film would have thematically, characters. I mean, you see Kirk, Spock, and McCoy in this thing. You know, it was a huge influence. In fact, Lily came in while I was watching it and said, "My God, what a ripoff of Star Trek this is!" Not realizing it was 11 years earlier. How about Robbie the Robot being the first robot, right? In any robot. You know, its adaptation of the themes and plot line of The Tempest, Shakespeare's The Tempest. So a lot of great stuff going on. And I just, you know, if people haven't seen The Forbidden Planet, it's fun. It's fun for all ages. It's still that word forbidden. You know, it is about going in and dealing with the forbidden in the psyche. And it doesn't date it in that way. In fact, Dean, I would say some of this stuff that we learned about in doing Truth Is Out There and working on our follow-up, this movie might be more relevant today, because the movie is actually, when you think about it, about techniques of conscious co-creation.
What is it?
Yeah, I think that that's what the Krell had realized that they could do. They could use their minds to manipulate matter, but they didn't do all the depth work to really shine a light into their own unconscious. And that was their undoing. And I mean, this is stuff that people are talking about today, right?
Yeah, for sure.
We manifest the world around us. And and so it becomes incumbent upon us to bring as much consciousness to the darkness as possible within ourselves.
Yeah.
So anyway, great.
Now I'm going to watch that again.
Yeah.
It's been so long since I've seen that.
And you
I
know,
loved it when I saw it.
When I first saw it, that was the first time I ever saw Walter Pidgeon. And so I've always had this idea of Walter Pidgeon as this uncomfortable actor who clearly feels a little bit out of place in a science fiction film. And only over the last year or so have I been really realizing what a great career throughout his life Walter Pidgeon had, and what a great actor he was. So
That Forbidden Planet was sort of like he was unsure he should have taken that part, I think.
But then it led to doing that Irwin Allen series, right? Or what was it? Voyage of the Bottom of the Sea or something?
Not Pigeon at the Bottom of the Sea. Voyage to the Bottom of the
That's
Sea.
That's what Pigeon at the Bottom of the Sea was his memoir. Now, what is it? This is your parallax experience. Right, okay.
Ah, it sure is, yeah.
Hey, the season of, not classic films, but the season of self-congratulation is upon us here in Hollywood.
Hooray!
Dean Haglund.
And I want to nominate you, sir, for congratulating you for doing what you do.
No, please, let me congratulate myself.
I will wait for my nomination. It's just enough to be nominated.
I nominate you to nominate yourself. And just to be nominated to nominate yourself, we're all winners. But indeed, the season that we call the season of self-congratulation, where where everything becomes about what movies are going to win awards, began this weekend with the announcement of the Independent Spirit nominations. And we have not always, some years we've paid close attention to this, some years the Indie Spirit Awards were great prognosticators of the Oscars. The Film Independent has made a concerted effort, apparently, to move away from that, to really have their awards be an independent voice. Why do I care? Because, for the first time ever, yours truly, Phil Airness, a voting member
of
the Independent Spirit Awards. So,
changing the way Hollywood congratulates itself.
I'm now at the point where when I go to awards screenings, Dean, I have to choose which of the three voting bodies I'm a member of to list on the screening information.
Look at you.
Yeah, I don't know. If you're not paying close attention, you might miss the fact that I'm congratulating myself right now. Okay. But anyway, I was looking at these, you know, just the what's kind of interesting is that the Indie Spirit Awards, they give... They try to focus on American independent films. So, for example, a film like The Danish Girl with Eddie Redmayne and Alicia Vikander that's getting a lot of Oscar talk is an independent film. It's below the budget level, but it's seen as predominantly an international film. So it's only eligible in a couple of categories. But I love that the Spirit Awards basically have three categories of feature awards, you know, like best features. They've got their overall best feature, the likes of which of Beasts of No Nation, Netflix's theatrical release, is nominated. Anomalisa, which I've heard is great, an animated film from Charlie Kaufman, that's nominated. Carol, which I'm seeing tomorrow night, which I heard all the way back at Cannes was the best film of the year, which critics in the UK and Europe have voted as the second best film of out of like 400 of the year.
Holy crap.
Spotlight, which is the ensemble film I talked about that deals with the story of, you know, the Boston Globe's expose of the Catholic Church cover-up of pedophilia. These are nominated, as is Tangerine. They also have, though, a best first feature category.
Oh, and, neat.
You know, so there's five films in there, and I'm going to try to see all those. And what I love about that is that that award is given to both the director and the producer of those films. Isn't that nice?
That's a nice thing.
As opposed to like Best Picture, which is given to producers traditionally, which is so confusing to Europeans who go, wait a minute, the director doesn't get the Best Picture award.
The Best Picture.
And then there's a category called the John Cassavetes Award, which is given to the best feature made for under $500,000. And that award is given to the writer, the director, and the producer. And one of these five that are nominated is a film that you and I have both championed on this show, Advantageous.
Hooray!
Which
It's about time.
Which, again, we came to through our effort to try to see as many of these films on the list, the Film Fatales list of recent female-directed movies that everyone should see. Our desire to you know, to seek out work by female directors. And so I will try to see these other ones, but I have a rooting interest.
Yes, me too. I'll be watching closely now. And, of course, at Brisbane SupernovaCon, my feet were put to the fire by one of our listeners who said she noticed that it's been 4 weeks that have gone by and I haven't seen a single film on that list. I was admonished and ashamed by her realization.
Good. So you'll be able to tell me which one you saw in just a few moments.
See, she just told me yesterday, though. So
But, you know, it's in fairness to her, she's letting you off the hook because it's been your turn forever. And I actually, after a few weeks, stepped in with one because I was feeling so ashamed on your behalf. So it's not that you're one behind. It's like you're three behind, man.
Okay. Okay, so
and you know, here comes... we talked about again a little bit last week the cultural ramifications of female-driven films and female-directed films, and this is a kind of a pet topic for us. It's important, but I was noticing weekend before. We're just ending the Thanksgiving weekend, which is always a big weekend at the U.S. box office. But the week before, three films directed by women opened on the same day.
Wow.
And I mean, I can't recall that that's ever happened before.
Not in the theaters.
And they're not little known movies either. They opened opposite Spectre, a little independent film focusing on on a spy,
by the Broccoli Brothers
and the Peanuts, Peanuts movie. So those two opened on the same week, but three other films seeking different kind of niches in the marketplace opened that were directed by women. Jesse Nelson's Love the Coopers, which is a Thanksgiving comedy. Patricia Riggins, The 33, which is the true story of the Chilean miners.
Oh, yeah.
And Angelina Jolie Pitt's By the Sea, the passion project for her and husband Brad Pitt. Those all opened on Friday. All of them failed to find audiences. And,
do you blame the female director on that? Or could it be, the actual log lines on some of them?
Well, honestly, all three movies are supposed to be dreadful.
Great. Really?
Yeah, they're all supposed to be dreadful. They're all just, look, anybody who let Angelina Jolie direct another movie after Unbroken, it's done. Stop letting her direct. Put that money in and let a handful of other female directors use that money to make movies, for crying out loud.
Right.
But
and the 33 Miners, I believe I saw that. Called live television when the drama was unfolding in front of me. Yeah. Why would I need to see that in a theater?
Exactly. If you don't have a story, a unique story that's coming out of character, it's just a docudrama, isn't it? So again, now is this the fault of the directors? Who knows? So much can go wrong in a movie, right? And who knows who's writing these? Who knows how they're packaged? But it's sad that these didn't find an audience. So if you're within the sound of my voice,
and you
say to yourself, "Boy, I wish these female directed films were supposed to be better, so that I could go support them," well, go seek out one of the many excellent female-directed films that we've talked about in weeks past, or that are on the Film Fatales list that you can Google of all-time great female-directed films, or of recent female-directed films that everyone should see. Because there are plenty of great, great films that need your support out there.
That's true.
So,
true enough.
I have been, I've been seeing movies like a madman, and we mentioned Spectre last week, just in connection to how much more resonant a spy film with a female lead, i.e. Sicario, was, But I didn't want to give Spectre short shrift by making it seem like it's not a good movie. I actually found it refreshing to have a James Bond adventure for the first time for the first time since Brosnan left, I would say that we get a James Bond adventure. Because although Casino Royale was a great, great movie, it was the origin story of James Bond.
Yes, a reboot.
And the subsequent films are not really James Bond adventures. You know, we've gone into such a darker, personal life of James Bond. And this is the closest I think we're going to get to a Daniel Craig James Bond adventure, and it was, to some respects, kind of a throwback then to the really good kind of Roger Moore films like Octopussy or For Your Eyes Only or that, especially with the return of Blofeld and Spectre. So I think for a James Bond fan, it's a quite enjoyable experience.
Oh, good.
You know, there's so much about how Skyfall is the greatest Bond film ever. It's the biggest box office for a Bond film, blah, 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 blah. But I increasingly find that Skyfall's the favorite James Bond movie of people that don't really like James Bond that much.
See, I think that's the case. And I think if you see Skyfall and then use that to grow and see the other James Bonds, go back and see the Sean Connerys and realize how that is supposed to go,
mm-hmm.
that Skyfall in the future may not hold its water all that well.
That's an interesting point, because I have found that there, in the wake of it, there is a revisionist history going on with Bond that just kind of has me perplexed. You know, I mentioned Octopussy, I mentioned Fear Eyes Only, several other films that, you know, when they came out, and look, critics would have no problem slamming Bond films throughout the years. But when Fear Eyes Only and then Octopussy came out, those got very good reviews, and they received very, very good box office returns. Never Say Never Again, Connery's Return, got good reviews, did good box office. These were good Bond movies, and now, like, the revisionist history on them is that they're among the worst ever made. But they were actually among the best during the period of the 70s and the 80s.
That's a lot.
And the Brosnan films... you know, it's almost like, first of all, if you grew up on Pierce Brosnan films, well, obviously the depth of the Craig films is either going to really turn you on or really frighten you, one or the other. But if those are the ones you know, then indeed, I don't think you have a clue as to James Bond.
Right.
Because they're both outliers.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's sort of that shift as in... Superman and Batman darkens in the Dark Knight series, that we all go into the psychological depth with our characters. So too, that we apply that mask to the James Bond thing, that you then criticize the other ones for not having deep psychological trauma coming out in the characters.
So I think you will enjoy it. And there is a master shot at the beginning, a la... You know, people want to say, oh, it's like Birdman. Well, that's an odd comparison. how about a la the opening of Touch of Evil? That would be more to the point. Setting up the entire action film with an unbelievable master shot at the beginning. And there's no way that the film is anything but a little bit downhill after that, because, you know, it's just so fantastic. But
that's awesome.
It's a lot of fun, and I can't urge you enough to see Sicario with Emily Blunt and Benicio del Toro and the Josh thank the Lord for Brolin. he's just so good in just about everything, you know.
He really is. It's amazing.
And just so much joy in all his performances. But the other spy film that I saw and I alluded to last week was Spielberg's Bridge of Spies.
Yes. Now, there's Oscar talk for this thing. Tell me, is it justified?
Well, you know, the first half of the movie was very good. And this tells the story of the man, the lawyer, the insurance lawyer, who, after being the prosecuting attorney at Nuremberg, prosecuting the war criminals, became partner in a law firm in New York as an insurance attorney. And because of his track record in serving in the military, doing his patriotic duty in prosecuting the war crimes, is called upon to be the defender for a man arrested for spying on the U.S. on behalf of the Soviets, to give this person their... you know, their constitutional due, a good defense in court.
Right.
And of course, by doing the job that he was enlisted to do, death threats, hatred, he became possibly even more so than the spy he was defending, the most hated man in America. And that was not helped when he was able, upon the conviction of this man, he took that conviction all the way to the Supreme Court, because the warrant used against him was illegal. And the Supreme Court basically said, well, we're not sure he's due constitutional rights, on a 5-4 split. And the speech, the legendary you know, argument that he gave before the Supreme Court is amazing. It's amazing. But and played by Tom Hanks, of course, just a fantastic casting. But he becomes the most hated man in America, and even more so when sentencing is due and he single-handedly talks behind the scenes the judge out of giving this spy the death penalty. And the reason that he talks him out is, look, we have to believe that in the foreseeable future, one of ours is going to get caught over there. And if we kill this one, we have nothing to swap. Cut to U2 pilot Gary Powers being shot down. And the second half of the film is about this man being an unofficial envoy with no power going behind the Iron Curtain while the wall is being built in East Berlin, literally being built around him, going in without any official status to negotiate an exchange between spies. And while there, finding out that an American graduate student had been held just as a political gambit by the East Germans in hopes that we would recognize their fledgling government. And he says, okay, I'll trade you one for two. And so it's this. And why the movie works is that this man is so interesting. And his story is so interesting. In fact, you know, we've talked about this before. When you know, it's almost like classic biopic is a contradiction in terms, you know,
yeah.
Because you can't have a biopic and make it be a classic because the story of someone's life does not make good filmmaking. You need to do an actual episode.
Right. Yeah. And you have to find the metaphor and the larger resonance of that story.
But, you know, an episode that could have been done is that Kennedy years later would send this man to Cuba to negotiate with Castro for the release of some 2,100 military members who were being held captive after the failed Bay of Pigs invasion. And not only does he get those 21, he comes back with 10,000 American prisoners. So good was this man at negotiating.
Wow.
But so that could have been a great, there could be a sequel. Spielberg, there's your sequel. So it is half an Oscar-worthy film, the first half, when it's dealing with the court case, when it becomes a spy movie, and sadly, the name of your movie is Bridge of Spies.
Right.
It is tired and uncompelling. And hard to believe, even though I'm seeing that they're shooting on some of the actual locations where you and I shot parts of Truth Is Out There.
You're kidding. Isn't this, though, a Spielberg movie?
It is a Spielberg movie.
Isn't a spy thing his forte? Isn't he the action guy? What?
I guess. You know who's really missed, and I never thought I would say this, is John Williams. The music is so unremittingly telling us exactly... I forget who the composer is on this, but it's so unremittingly telling us what to feel. So anyway, half a good movie. There's something comforting, again, as always, about seeing Tom Hanks do good work. The actor who plays the Russian spy, whose name, great British stage actor, and I'm forgetting his name. He's worthy of a supporting actor Oscar. But overall... it's no great shakes, man.
Wow. Okay, off my list.
But I will tell you who's in it, who turns up, who would have been a fun character to explore more as a East German lawyer. Actor Sebastian Koch, who played the theater writer and director in that great German film, The Lives of Others.
Oh, yeah.
He turns up in this, and he turns up in a movie I alluded to earlier, The Danish Girl. He's plays the doctor who performed the first ever sex change operation. And it's so exciting seeing this guy get these big, high-profile, you know, cachet English-speaking roles because he's so good.
He is a great actor. He's really, really grounded. I love that. Like, he underplays a lot of his characters. I love that. So I'm glad he's getting all this stuff.
I saw The Danish Girl last night, and everybody's saying that this is back-to-back Oscar wins for Eddie Redmayne playing the titular character of The Danish Girl, who was a famous landscape artist.
Right.
from Norway, who settled in Copenhagen, became a famous landscape artist, and then underwent was married and underwent you know, the transgender surgery to become Lily Elbe, and whose groundbreaking memoirs, "Man into Woman," "Woman into Man," "Man into Woman,"
"Man into Woman,"
are still read to this day, and. Great performance from Eddie Redmayne, maybe even to a degree, a more impressive performance from Alicia Vikander, who's had a great year. I mean, starring in Ex Machina, being the only decent thing in the absolutely awful Man from U.N.C.L.E. is no small feat. But the transformation that she undergoes as the wife of this individual is purely an energetic transformation and an emotional transformation, but the way she embodies it is no less impressive. And like I said, maybe even more impressive, really, when you think about it, because Eddie Redmayne, so many of the transformations are external, right? And this has to be how the person internally is growing exclusively. So her work is great, but what a potentially fascinating story told in the least interesting ways imaginable.
Oh, no.
They pull out every stop to tell this story in as uninteresting of ways as possible. In fact, the first hour before it dawns on anyone that this might be a woman born in a man's body, the film has pretty much all the depth of a Bosom Buddies episode.
Oh, ouch.
Yeah.
I think that's our call out. Holy smokes. That pathetic.
So, you know, I'm at this age in my life, and I've been there for a while where, you know,
4 days now.
Great. No, but great acting in a movie that really doesn't work doesn't, you know, ultimately it leaves me cold, you know, in the sense that it's not the actor's fault, of course. I'm not saying that, but let's start rewarding maybe actors whose work might be harder to notice in films that work, right?
Ah, yes.
When you're so transported by the movie that you're not noticing the performance, isn't there a way to reward those people maybe a little more than for some of the showier roles that we are appreciating? And one of the reasons we're appreciating it is because the movie's not working, so we're watching it in a way.
It's the old adage of play somebody handicapped or a thing and you get an Oscar, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
it sounds like this is another case.
Eddie
of that.
Redmayne, you are an award whore. You go from playing Stephen Hawking to playing the first sex change. What's next? Playing someone who's half mentally disabled in the next one? Because as we know from Tropic Thunder, you don't play full mentally disabled. That doesn't get you the award. Only half. Only half.
That's right.
The other big award hopeful that I saw yesterday that I couldn't wait to tell you about is The Big Short. And this is based on Michael Lewis's book. Michael Lewis wrote the book Moneyball, which examined the system of doing business invented by the Oakland A's under general manager Billy Beane. And the movie did the amazing thing of taking the book's explanation and bringing it to life in a way that not only non-baseball fans could understand, but that all people could really enjoy as just an entertaining workplace film. So now Michael Lewis attacks the subprime housing bubble and credit collapse of 2007, explaining how it happened, why it happened, and why it's happening again right now.
And what?
This movie does do a wonderful job of explaining that book in a way that we can understand. Is it as understandable and as entertaining as Moneyball, which was also produced by Brad Pitt and also starred Brad Pitt, as this one does? No, it's not the achievement that Moneyball was. But
because it's a straight line and there's baseball players in it. This subprime, I would think I'm only seeing bankers and real estate agents.
And there was a main character in Moneyball of that yes. general manager. There is no protagonist. There is no main character in this. There's a few key players, and they're all excellent. Steve Carell is doing excellent work as Mark Baum, Wall Street hedge fund. Christian Bale does fantastic work as Dr. Michael Berry, who is running his own fund out of San Jose and who was the first one to bet against these housing CDOs and these housing bonds and to realize that the market was going to collapse and made billions off the fail.
Short.
He basically bet. Yeah, it was the big short. He bet that the economy was going to collapse. And when it did, he made $3 billion.
Wow.
And instead of the government going and asking him, how did you know before anyone else did? You were getting sued by your own investors who said, what do you know that Alan Greenspan doesn't? Instead of going and asking him so that the government could figure out what they needed to be on the lookout for in the future, the FBI investigated him and he's been audited 4 times. So anyway, but here's the thing. The movie is entertaining. It is incredibly funny. And this is in large part thanks to writer-director Adam McKay, perhaps best known for the Anchorman movies.
Yes.
Or Talladega Nights. Not only does he do a wonderful job in terms of the script and the performances, but this man, he developed a look and a visual approach for the film. What, did I always think it worked? No. I think the first 20 minutes of the movie is a mess, but if you stay with it, it pays off. But what I love is he really, really did the work to make this movie and to come up with a way to tell the story visually that he felt really matched this kind of fragmented system, the fragmented nature of the ensemble. Because, yes, it's an ensemble picture, but that ensemble's never together. He really found an approach that worked with it. And I compare and contrast this work of a director known for frothy comedies with Jay Roach, who I told you, you know, did the Austin Powers movies and the Meet the Parents,
yeah.
and who directed that Trumbo movie. And his utter failing to make a movie that would have matched the subject matter.
Damn it.
You know? And so here's two yeah. directors known for comedy. And one does the job of a director and shows, wow, he's capable of more than we might, even me, who's a fan, might have thought that he was.
Right.
And whereas Jay Roach does exactly what you expect from him, which is to make an HBO movie and
of a really more. Actually fascinating time in history.
Yeah.
And a fascinating character in the middle of that.
Yeah. So I'm not sure The Big Short will get any nominations for anything. I mean, maybe screenplay in this. But a wildly entertaining film. And, you know, I want to be careful throwing the word important around too much when we're films are concerned. But look, understanding what happened and how it's happening again right now, that is kind of important.
Wow. I didn't realize it was happening again right now.
Yeah. In fact, I just saw that CDOs, which are illegal... have started this year to be sold again. And how can they get to sell them again? They changed what they call them.
Oh.
But what?
Yeah, that classic.
Yeah, that's it. That's all they had to change in order to get to sell them again.
Yeah, they're a different financial instrument if we call them something else.
Yeah, change its name.
Yeah, that's right.
We're not the Fantastic. Airline that... That keeps crashing.
Crash. Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, we're at the end of just another hour, and we didn't even get to still the funniest screenplays of all time. We're gonna have
Damn
to
it.
Just do that. Maybe we'll do that as just a whole thing,
show.
And
yeah.
We'll do half the show talking about the funniest screenplays of all time, and then the other half getting to these letters. From listeners, because we have a couple
that are piling up.
Ones.
I bet they're piling up.
A couple good ones. So I have a little special pre-recorded closing for this week's show that ties in with something we discussed earlier. So why don't I just say goodbye to you now and wish you big fun and much success on tonight's Paper Laugh Show.
Thank you very much, Phil Lerness. We'll see you next week.
Take care. Talk to you next week.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is our robot. A housewife's dream. He's been very good on the set, done everything we've asked him to do. But I sometimes wonder when we've finished work on stage 27 and Robbie's here alone, when the technicians have all gone home and the machinery is shut off, is he really off? Or does this machine which we have built, this complicated metal being, does it really have a brain? I sometimes wonder.
Forbidden planet. Forbidden planet indeed.
You can find every installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com. C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K Hollywood.com. You can download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes, even write a review. As Dean Haglund would say, what could be more fun? Please write us, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Tell us what you want us to talk about, and we'll be glad to do so on the show. That's one of the things we mean when we say it's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Thanks to Empire State Gas for sponsoring us, Blog Talk Radio for hosting us, Fanboy Nation for carrying us. Please follow us on Twitter, won't you? We're at Dean and Phil, and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. Until next week, I'm Phil Lernis. Be good to yourselves, everybody.
Belated spoiler alert.